Those of you who were here 2 weeks ago know I covered 2 Samuel chapter 12. You also know, if you were here then, that I got like through verse 6. So we're going to finish off 2 Samuel 12 today. But so now we're going to go back to it and finish this book off, or this chapter off. I need to finish it off because 13 and 14 are going to tie into it pretty heavily. At the risk of going back to chicken and egg question, are there any questions or issues regarding this particular chapter? Well, those of you who recall last week, or 2 weeks ago, we had discussed the wayfarer, the story that Nathan had given. And of course, as John Walsh had pointed out, that Nathan and God knew David very, very well, knowing full well he was a passionate or emotional person. He would strike out immediately with the story and with his gut, as opposed to thinking it through as what Nathan was actually saying. And so Nathan, of course, pronounced his own judgment of four times death plus loss of all your wives. Well, four of his sons were killed each other, and some most of them. And of course, he lost his wives, all his wives, to Absalom. So by God and Nathan setting him up this way, they said, "All right, David, what is your punishment?" And David inadvertently gave his own punishment. Had he thought about it, he probably would have said, "Slap of the wrist." That would have been obviously God would have not, we wouldn't be reading about it if that was the case. So as you know, we didn't get through past, verse 6, whatever it was. We did mention a few things past that, but not too many. Let's see here. So, this is a question that Carrie had actually brought up after that day 2 weeks ago. She asked me privately about this question, and I gave her a partial answer at the time because knowing I was going to talk about it this week to finish it off. Verse 8. $1 million question, or one of the many of them. Nathan, of course, is relaying to David that you are the man. This is God's punishment for you for sleeping with Bathsheba and taking Uriah's wife, of course, killing Uriah. Nathan, of course, says, I gave you the house of your Lord and the women of your Lord into your bosom and gave over to you the house of Israel and Judah. And if this were not enough, I would have increased for you this much and much again. That's my text words it that way, which implies you would have doubled what you have once and then again. Not meaning four times you have, meaning three times what you have. That's the Hebrew phrasing of it. And she had asked this question, which is the obvious question. He has six wives. Is God offering him 12 more offering? Would have God have offered him 12 more wives? Is that what God's saying here? It's not a simple question. It's not immediate no. Well, no, because it's not immediate no, because it's not what's actually being said. It says it will increase. It doesn't specify what's going to be increased, whether it's just children, whether it's just land, nothing in particular. But he does reference it that, yes, you are a man. I gave you over the house of your Lord and the women of your Lord into your bosom. Well, those are two items, the house and the women. And I gave you over the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Well, those four items, which God was going to already gave David, he's going to increase them. I will not make excuses the Bible. I'm not going to say, well, this is really what God actually meant this. He didn't mean to say it that way. To make it sound better to our sensibilities. The Bible is not written toward our sensibilities. Would God have increased the women he had? Apparently, yes. That's what the text says. We don't like that. Well, why would God do that? That's against the Torah, isn't it? Well, no, actually it's not. Well, why would God do this? This doesn't make sense. This is contrary to what we understand of him. Isn't he an all-loving God desiring us to understand his spiritual nature and desiring us to follow him at all costs? You know, one man, one woman, that's the way God always intended it. Yes, he also never intended us to divorce either. And yet there are still laws allowing divorce in the Bible. So there are a lot of things that God intends for us to do as human beings walking toward him. There are a lot of things he made provisions for, writing down rules when you break those intentions, but go along a different route. God could have easily written in Exodus or Leviticus rules about one man has only one wife. But he didn't. He instead wrote rules about what any other wives may or may not be. They may not be siblings to your current wife. They may not be relatives to you, your father. We read actually part of Leviticus 20 as well as 18 discussed what the extra relations can and cannot be, but nothing that says you cannot have a second wife in this text. Now, we have obviously a New Testament that says, hey, wait a minute. The intention was one man, one woman. Even Titus points out that if you wish to be a godly person in your congregation group or society, you would have no more than one wife, period. So there are even rules, but yet the rule clearly had to be written down even during Messiah's time. They still have multiple wives. Hence the rule was written down. So would God have increased David's wives? Apparently, yes. Did God increase Solomon's wives? Well, yeah, look how many he had. How many wives were increased by a lot of people, a lot of the kings? Quite a few had multiple wives. Is this against the law? No. Is it against God's intention for our lives? The spirit of the law? Well, yeah, it's against the spirit of the law. That wasn't God's goal. It wasn't his intention at all. But I had to address that issue. Because she did bring it up, and I wanted to bring it up, because I know it's not a very pleasant topic to talk about. Don't get me wrong, nobody's advocating multiple wives. I'm just discussing what the text actually says. That's it. I'm not going to make an excuse for it. Any questions or issues with that? Yes, Ellie.
Isn't there within the Torah somewhere that says a king shouldn't multiply his wives?
You cannot multiply horses. See here. The high priest is only to have one wife. The king's not mentioned regarding when he can't multiply his wives. So now, Solomon warns a king will multiply his wives, but now the king doesn't multiply his wives. And then it's undesirable. I could be wrong. If you find the Torah, the law, it's not coming to my head at all. But maybe I'm just not recalling it at all. I believe Samuel. 1 Samuel discusses most rules your text might have a reference to it in the Torah law, possibly. When they first asked for a king. Having said that, now let's move on a little bit. Well, you're welcome to come back to it if you find scripture otherwise. Okay. So that's where verse 8 goes. Now, as we discussed last time, verse 10, 11, and 12, of course, give the details of what God's going to have toward David as punishment for the murder of Uriah and stealing of somebody else's wife. This is the whole, the sword will depart from your house, I'll raise an adversary from your neighbor, which will obviously be his son. And he's going to do it openly versus secretly. We know the story. We just read it. The sword never leaving David's house. Yes, we mentioned four of David's sons kill each other. Absalom kills Amnon, his older brother. Actually, Joab kills Absalom. But Absalom killed Amnon. Let's see here. Solomon kills Adonijah. Who was the fourth one? Oh, that's right, the boy right here. Bathsheba's first child dies. So that's all four sons that are all killed. We'll discuss some of the details of how that implies, or what it implies later. Hopefully, we'll get to those. David, of course, shows obvious remorse. Now, there's one statement he says to Nathan. What was his one phrase? Behold, I have sinned to the Lord. And Nathan's response, so too, the Lord has commuted your sin. You will not die. However, of course, you could blaspheme the enemies of the Lord, and this man and his son is born to you, will surely die. the one phrase that David gives all of a sudden makes it all better. Does it seem funny to you? David says, oh, I sinned. And David says, you're forgiven. That was quick, wasn't it? I would love to live my life that way. Oh, God, I sinned. Oh, you're forgiven. Thank you. I sinned. You're forgiven. Thank you. Why is it that Nathan immediately forgives him the moment he says, oh, I've sinned? Why is that? Why don't we hear a heartfelt plea? Where is that? It's not written here in verse 13. Because David wrote Psalm 51 instead for us as his heartfelt plea. And then we're going to read that. This is what was David, in this one little phrase, I have sinned to the Lord, meant. And Nathan, I believe, knew this. Or God at least knew it. Psalm 51 was David's response when Nathan comes to him regarding Bathsheba. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to your loving kindness. According to the multitude of your tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is forever before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight, that you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Behold, you desired truth in the inward parts, and the hidden part you will make me to know wisdom. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which you have broken may rejoice. Hide your face from my sins, and blot out my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast away me from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation, and uphold me with your generous spirit. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners shall be converted to you. Deliver me from blood guiltness, O God, the God of my salvation, and my tongue shall sing aloud of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth shall show forth your praise. For you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offerings. The sacrifices of God are a broken heart, that is, a broken spirit, and a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. Do good in your good pleasure to Zion. Build the walls of Jerusalem. Then you should be pleased with the sacrifices of righteousness, with burnt offerings, with whole burnt offerings. Then they shall offer bulls on your altar. That was what David's heart said when he said, I have sinned to the Lord. Now, David's called a prophet, is he not? Many ways. The Messiah actually refers to him as prophet. In Psalms 51, what do you see prophecy in that one? Anything at all? I mentioned this 2 weeks ago because I find it very, very prophetic. The sacrifices of God are a broken heart, broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. When we sin, and the Torah gives us rules and regulations to how to cover up or take care of these sins, pay for them through a death of a particular animal or whatever we must do. Is that God's objective? Well, of course it's not his objective. What is his objective when we have to deal with all these various animals to kill or to slaughter? Well, it's there. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. That's God's goal. That's his objective. That's what he wants for us. When we sin, not to say, oh, bummer, I sinned again. I'm sorry, God, please forgive me. Is that a broken heart? Is that a broken spirit? It isn't, is it? To be devastated the fact you sinned against God? That's what God wants. To be that devastation, the destruction that's within you, that I did something that I should never have done. To get that emotion, that response, because those responses and those emotions help us to not sin the next time around. They last with us. They make permanent changes in us. That's what David is feeling. That's what Nathan saw. He says, you did sin against God, and your heart is broken. Look at his response to his son. Was his heart broken? Yeah, it was. What father wouldn't be broken in that fashion? Wouldn't desire to give his own life in a heartbeat to save his son? All of us would. That's who we are. That's what makes us who we are. That broke David's heart. And that was God's goal. David, you have to understand you did something that is not beyond, it's beyond worthy of death. You disappointed him. You disappointed God. David understood that. David believed it. He felt it. That was a prophetic moment in time in David's life at this event. That moment said, ah, I understand. It's not that I need to pay for my sin. That wasn't the point. But I need to understand what I did and feel it and understand what Uriah would be thinking and feeling if he was still alive. That his own king betrayed him. That's a broken heart. That's destruction. Not external, not you know, leveling the buildings, but with inside you. Continuing on. Or any questions regarding that? Yes, Ellie. Did you find the verse?
Yes. It's Deuteronomy 17, verse 17 and 18. Neither shall he, this is instructions to the king. Verse 17, neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests and the Levites. And it will be with him and he'll read it all the days of his life to fear God.
Yeah, Deuteronomy is written after David, not before. That's the whole only drawback with it. Yeah, Deuteronomy is written post David's life and death, not before his life and death. Yeah, the change is, yeah. Sorry, I guess I should be more careful when I just said the Torah doesn't discuss it. Note, as I was actually talking with my father a few minutes ago, there are rules that are written in the Torah. And it's almost like God goes out of his way to find people to break them. So you can see the consequences of when you break this rule. As this is what happens. You go, obviously, through Jacob and, of course, his multiple wives. And don't get wrong, I'm not saying... Deuteronomy, the laws are not Torah. I just said they're written after David. I mean that they were written down in their fashion after David. Much like how Jacob with his multiple wives. And the Torah explicitly, do not marry a wife and then marry her sister. What did Jacob do? He married all four sisters. Yes, they were all four related. He married all... Was there a law written before Jacob that says don't do that? No. Look what happened to Jacob. Okay, God said, write this law down. Don't do this again. Things you don't do. You don't do this stuff. This creates problems. I also, even in Leviticus, think it also points out that you don't marry your sister, whether it's from your father or your mother. What did Abraham do? He married his sister. Oops, don't do that. It has problems. Look what happened with Abraham and, of course, with the Philistine king. I forgot. Abimelech and all the whole, oh, well, she's my sister, oh, she's not. It's confusing and it's a funny story. But a lot of rules written because people said, oh, I can do this. No, you can't. Don't do that. So, yeah, so Deuteronomy rules regarding kings written after the kings had already started. So I apologize. I should be more careful when I said that. Right.
I didn't have that in mind.
Right. That wasn't my intention. Right. I should be more careful. I apologize for that one. Still, however, it does point out that God does he say he would increase it, which would also increase wives, and God's claiming to do so. So it produces a conundrum, but then also it's a factor in that the Torah and the laws are not written for God to follow. They're written for men to follow. God steps outside of his own laws all the time. Why? To get his point across, to get his objective accomplished. Because he doesn't say, God, don't marry your own wives, or don't marry multiple of your own sisters. Does it say that? It doesn't. God doesn't do that. The Torah is written for men, not for God. The holy days are meant for man to follow, not for God to follow. He does. Because I can tell you right now, when I pray on Shabbat, God still answers some of those prayers. Does that mean he's working? He's working on Sabbath then, isn't he? If he's listening to me coming down, okay, go ahead, I'll listen now. He's working on Shabbat. Ugh. Does that mean he's breaking his Shabbat? No, it's his. He can do whatever he wishes. The law of rules he doesn't necessarily listen to. I will concede. I apologize. I should be more careful with my wording. Okay, let's continue. Oh, any other questions regarding that, though? All right. Continue on. That was David's heart. We understood David's heart now. And of course, as we obviously see, the child dies. And his servants didn't quite grasp what David was doing. But he tried to explain it to him, that God's will after death is really not that valuable to David. It didn't accomplish it. God accomplished what he prophesied he would do. Though David attempted to undo it, it was obviously unsuccessful. I don't want to talk about that just yet. Well, I'll go and talk about it now. It doesn't hurt. So Bathsheba has, of course, the first child dies, and the second child is Solomon, right? How many children does Bathsheba have, or end up having? With David. Sorry, be careful. There's four total. The children are listed in 1 Chronicles. Let's see here. 1 Chronicles chapter 3. I'm bringing this up because it brings up a question. It's always worth it exploration. Chapter 3, verse 5. Yes, verse 5. It says, this is a list of the genealogy of the sons of David. These were born to him in Jerusalem. This is verse 5. Shemaiah, Shobab, Nathan, and Solomon. Four by Bathsheba, the daughter of Amiel, or Emil. Is Solomon listed number 2 there? Why is he listed as the fourth child? Doesn't make sense, does it? Doesn't make sense. Chronicles 14 records the same order. 14 verse 4. Let's see. This is the David, of course, multiple wives in Jerusalem. Names of his children, he had Jerusalem, Shemaiah, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon. Ibihar, Elishua, Epithet, all the various children he had in Jerusalem. So the question for you, is Solomon her second child? Maybe. Could it be her last child? Oh, I'm sorry. It's 1 Chronicles 4, or 3, and 4, and then 1 5, and then 1 Chronicles 14, verse 4. Is he number 2 or number 4? Second one from Bathsheba. Are you sure? Chapter 3, verse 5 says he's the fourth one from Bathsheba. This is actually saying who his mother is in chapter 14. It doesn't express who the mother is, but chapter 3 does. Of all four children. Now, note, you could ask, well, maybe they're just not written in biological order. You know, it could be just the list of children he had. If he's number 4. Or not number 4, he just happens to be in the fourth one written down. That's a legitimate argument. Maybe he still was number 2, but he happened to list it here in 1 Chronicles as the fourth child. Well, if that were true, then verse, and also back in chapter 3, verse 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, and 8 should be written also some random order. But they're not. They're written in chronological order. Events, child to child to child, just as recorded in 2 Samuel. This is where we have our issues with chronology versus subject matter. God does not write things chronologically. It doesn't matter to him. He writes things subject matter, thematically, event-based. Whether or not point A comes before or after point B makes no difference to him. What does point A say? That's what matters to God. If you look very, actually anywhere in the entire Bible is written that way. Very little of it is in chronological order. It's our Western mindset that tries to locate them in chronological order. We put the books in the same order because we, oh, well, this event happened next, and then this event happened next, and that's how we think. That's not how God necessarily thinks. He thinks in subject matter. When this is relevant, he'll point it out. When it's not relevant, he doesn't point it out yet. He'll point it out somewhere later or earlier. Makes no difference. He's done it many times throughout the book of Genesis. He does it numerous times throughout the minor prophets. And of course, there's obviously Revelations, which is smattered all over it. It's practically written in verse in many ways. But that's just how he writes. How he authors the data. It's designed to make us jump around and read more stuff. He's very good at it, too. But so whether or not he is the second or fourth child doesn't technically matter. But the objective was here was to point out that Solomon comes from her. And her and David. That was the objective here written in 2 Samuel. Whether he's number two or number four, who cares? He comes from her. Hence, it's listed. Note, to point out the example, in chapter 12, how does the book end? How does the chapter end? This just accentuates the point. It goes and returns back to the war of the children of Ammon. Well, that would imply that the fight against this one city of Rabbah took a little over 2 years. Highly unlikely, consider that to be the longest battle ever. Even Troy fell faster than that. The battles don't last two straight years because chapter 12 encompasses obviously 11 and 12. Obviously, all the men go off to war to fight Rabbah, the city of Rabbah. David sees Bathsheba. Oh, has her affair, conceives, gives birth to a child. 9 months later, a few days later that week, 2 weeks, whatever, child dies. He conceives again. 9 more months go by. Then there's Solomon. That's with a gap between both kids. That's about 2 years. And then David goes off and destroys Rabbah, the children of Ammon. The point isn't that she has two children in the time which Rabbah has taken. The point is that the death of that child happens at this event. Oh, and by the way, Solomon comes from her too. Continue on with the story. That's the objective. That was God's point. That's what the author here wrote it. It's not that he's number two or number four. It doesn't make a difference. And it's not that she had time to have two children in that time span. That also wasn't the point. The point is just to, hey, this affair that occurred also resulted in something good over here, known as Solomon. Whether Solomon was born before or after, the second, third, or fourth child doesn't make any difference, but it happened then. Chronicles records him as a fourth child. Is Chronicles right? Maybe. Maybe they're right. Does it matter? Probably not. Does Solomon ever have another mention of a younger sibling ever again in the rest of the entire Bible? No. He mentions all of his older brothers, but doesn't mention any of his younger siblings, if he had any. He would be the youngest. Correction, he could have been the youngest. We don't know if he was. But it doesn't matter. The point is that even though it's recorded differently in the order of things, it's still the event was that he came from her. Now, why would God want to point out that Solomon came from her and David? Why do you want to point it out here in chapter 12? What was the objective of pointing out in chapter 12? Was it just for the fun of it, so we would know? I was bored, I wrote it down, a few extra verses. Didn't you be my quota for the day? Personally speaking, my opinion, of course, he did it probably Because he liked Bathsheba. God did. And he probably knew full well this was the intention of him all along with Bathsheba and David. This was my objective, to get Solomon out of this relationship. Peace would come from war. Yes, Ellie.
If Solomon is the second son of Bathsheba, there are 6 children born to David before that. The 7th child is the one that dies, and Solomon would have been the 8th child, which would have started a new division.
That's possible.
Yeah.
That's possible. Don't get me wrong, I'm not going to put a whole lot of credence in how First Chronicles records dates and times written and existed before they were writing anything down. But these guys are writing stuff down after it happened, by the way, not before. Hence, they can record all of Solomon's children and grandchildren all in the same text because they're writing afterward. But it's still interesting to just note. But I believe that God intended for Bathsheba and David to come together to produce Solomon. I believe that was God's intention all along. Personally speaking, I think that because chapter 7 of 2 Samuel, because full well, there will be a child that you do not have yet that's going to come forth and will be my chosen one to develop my house, to build my house. At the time which God says that to David, David already has 6 children, 6 sons. And possibly Tamar, I'm not sure when his daughter showed up or not. We'll see. He already had those. And then God said, one you don't have will be the king. So what's the next child that happened? Well, Bathsheba. That would give even more credence to David wanting to save the child's life. Saying, God, isn't this the one? Isn't this the one you promised back in chapter 7? Well, he didn't say chapter 7, but he's earlier. That this would be the one, by a child, a son that isn't here yet, this would be the one, this is the one that's supposed to be king, why would you kill this child? Well, because that promise was fulfilled, but not for this one, but through the same relationship. Same mom, same dad. Hence, God wrote it down here. That's my opinion, of course. You can disagree if you wish. So you have, of course, continue on, children of Ammon. Let's see here. Well, we'll get these questions here in a minute, or the last question here in a minute. Goes back to the story, returns children of Ammon to this whole battle that's going on. It says, hey, you know, I've taken the city, they've taken his water supply. David, of course, comes, they take out the town, and he puts everybody to work. Now, this is terribly important, but I find it interesting. Which I think is also somewhat prophetic, too. In verse 30, David removes the crown from the head, whether it be the head of the king of the town or the god, we'll find out, and it weighed a talent of gold and a precious stone. Some of your Bibles record this. How much does a talent of gold weigh? A lot. To be more precise, it's 112.5 pounds. A talent of gold weighs 112.5 pounds. Please volunteer to put 112.5 pounds on your head. Any takers? Wow. That's heavy. So it makes you question, how was it? Now, granted, David's not a little guy, but how did he get 112.5 pounds on his head, and it remained on his head? He battled with the king. It remained over David's head. This is verse 30. He kept it. How? Any ideas? It has to do with the prophetic part. It's not that the thing weighed that much. It was valued that much. Because of what? The precious stone. Note, the Hebrew word weight and value is the same. Or very similar, isn't it the same? Very similar. So, it is equivalent to a talent of gold. Meaning, the crown, whatever it was made of, it could have silver, it could have beads, it could have been stone, who cares, it could have rocks. the value, due to the crown's design and the precious stone that was on it, was equivalent to a talent of gold. How much did it weigh? It doesn't really matter. Either way, David kept it. So what was prophetic about it? Why do I say that I think this is a prophetic part? After everything... Oh, go ahead.
You know, they've done excavations in Korea of ancient burial sites of the kings. And in one of the kingdoms, they found a crown that was probably almost that big.
That's a big crown.
And they pointed out in the article that I was reading that those kind of crowns would be for ceremonial purposes only.
Which makes sense. Right.
They were not something that you would wear during your day-to-day
basis.
Business to show off your rank.
Right.
They were for special ceremonies. So that would beg the question, if this crown that David obtained was similar, it probably did have some kind of ceremonial and then, therefore, like you say, prophetic significance.
Mm-hmm.
Ceremonial.
It's so heavy, she couldn't wear it, but heavy temporary on her head for a moment in time and lift it up.
That the axe extended so it wouldn't be on her head. The axe had things so it wouldn't be heavy on her, and then people couldn't see that part.
The reason I consider this slightly prophetic, you may think otherwise. It says in verse 30, he removed their king's crown from his head. They weighed a talent of gold, a precious stone, right over David's head, so he took out a great deal of booty from the city. The king's head. He moved their king's crown from his head. The Hebrew phrase doesn't actually necessarily mean it's a physical person. It's crown. Let's rephrase this. But the Hebrew alternate equivalent phrase would be, he removed their God's crown from his head. He removed Molech's crown from his head. He took the kingship. That was the prophetic part. The king of David now just became the king of Ammon too. Or king of Israel just became the king of Ammon too. That's what he was doing. He became everything. Why I think it's prophetic is because obviously Messiah was there too. But that even though David went through this horrible existence with Bathsheba, God still said, don't worry. You will still be my king. You'll still be my chosen one. That's confidence. That's belief. That's where I think Psalm 51 came into play. The God, that David says, it's the broken heart you want. It's the broken spirit. Broken meaning his own spirit. Follow God. That God still chose him, still selected him, still kept him. That's why I find it prophetic. Because the alternate reading is fair. It's equivalent reading. King or God are the same in that phrase. Yes, Ellie.
He's also telling David that your crown will go on forever. My son's going to come from you, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a beautiful image. Personal opinion. Now, my text is not quite as nice and pleasant as Jeff's text when he read this with regards to the punishment of the people of Ammon. But David wasn't known for his kindness when it comes to people who humiliate him or his men. Verse 31, it says, he took out the people of the city and punished them with saws and ironing threshing boards and with iron axes. And he dragged them through the muddy streets or the stone, cobblestone streets. That's what mine says. And this is what he would do to all the cities, the children of Ammon. What does that mean when you're punished through saws and threshing boards and iron axes and being dragged through muddy streets or cobblestone streets? You probably have some owies when you're done. Probably. I mean, I know I would. My skin's not that tough, not that thick. And it doesn't necessarily say David did it to every human inside the city. Most likely the individuals who were responsible for the humiliation of his own men back a few chapters earlier. That, as far as chapter 12 is concerned, I can't do much more until I read chapter 13 to go back and talk about Bathsheba a lot more. Bathsheba, as I mentioned many times already, Bathsheba, Eve, and Tamar are all thematically equivalent women. Not that their lives were identical, nothing of the sort, but the events and the results, not the events, the results were the same. There was a series of humiliation, a series of banishment of a style, different forms built for all three women, but they still all three got banished. Well, we won't discuss too many details regarding the type of sin and what they were thinking. But there was one question that came up 2 weeks ago that I failed to answer, which I feel I should answer, because even though the lady isn't here right now, that's okay. I should answer at some point in time. During all this process, how many of you asked or thought to yourself, during this time with David sees Bathsheba, why didn't she say no? Why didn't she say no? I'm already married. I mean, she is a human being. She has the ability to say yes and no to a lot of things. And actually, we have record of her and even her own phrases, statements to Solomon, her son, in Chronicles, discusses, and she tells him no. She has opinions. She has thoughts. Solomon disagrees with her, but still, she has thoughts. She tries to argue with him. Why doesn't she argue here with David? Why didn't she? Tammy.
There's a huge difference between arguing with your son versus arguing with a king who is probably 20 or 30 years older than you, who has bloody hands.
True. She could be just plain fearful. She goes, hey, you know, in somewhat reverence, somewhat respect, a little bit of fear, all of them intermingled together. Maybe she's too afraid. Her husband, Uriah, of course, is off to war at the king's command. Clearly the king knows who her husband is. It's possible. I don't have a direct answer. It's just an interesting question, because it was a question that was brought up, and I battled with myself. Why wouldn't she say no? Why would she say, hey, I'm married? Why would she raise up any kind of objection? Even Tamar's record, in the next chapter, she objects, says, wait a minute, Ammon, back off. This is inappropriate. So she at least recorded an objection. Bathsheba records no objection to this. It doesn't mean she didn't object. It just means she's recording. We don't know what she said. My personal opinion, it's not worth a whole lot on this issue in particular. But I think it has something to do with her father and grandfather. A little bit along the fear lines that Tammy pointed out. Because, yeah, he's the king. He's at least 20, maybe 30 years old. I'm not sure her exact age. She's not that old, though. She's relatively young at this point. It's what it appears to be. Based on how long she lives during Solomon's reign, she's pretty young here. Keep in mind, her grandfather was David's military advisor. And who was her father? Well, we're not sure, but most likely, based on who her grandfather was and who her husband was, probably somewhere also in David's entourage of men and servants. We don't know exactly what he did for certain. It may have been fear from him for her own safety or from the safety of her grandfather or father. That's also a factor there. We don't know all of what she's thinking. I would love to write down something that she said regarding this. But she doesn't. All she records is that, hey, I'm pregnant. You got to do something about this. That's the only phrase you get from her. When she tells David that, hey, I'm pregnant. But that's it's an interesting question to always ask yourself. Why didn't she say no? She probably did. We just don't know. If she's anything like the symbolism and the thematic tie between Eve and Tamar, she did say no. We'll discuss that in chapter 13 and 14. And that these women and the thematic ties when God repeats stories, not verbatim, repeats events to tell us something. The objective not only is to tell us more information about the current story, but also tell us more information about the previous story too. And with Tamar, she objects. Eve objects. Bathsheba probably objected because all the other women did. She followed suit. If she doesn't object, it deviates further from the previous examples of these women and men that sin in God's eyes and introduce death into their families. So most likely, my personal opinion, based upon the other women who are like her, not duplicate but similar, she probably objected.
And if she was the kind of woman to just willingly do this, she would not be the kind of woman that God would want to have to be the mother of
Solomon.
Of Solomon or anybody else.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I think that's most likely based on her character and who she became and how she even talked and interacted with Solomon and tries to have him understand compassion. She probably is that kind of woman who God would want, who God would desire for a mother of a king.